Namaste, this is Sri Akashna here, and you are watching Hollywood Reel with Jay Manez.
Welcome back to Hollywood Reel. Today's guest, formerly known as the yogi with the Lamborghini, Eric Ho, undertook a Himalayan journey of deep enlightenment that transformed his life. He emerged a spiritual master and today leads a following of millions of people seeking inspiration, guidance, and ultimately happiness. But his life started much, much differently. Please welcome my incredible friend, Master Sri Akashna. Welcome, brother.
Namaste.
Namaste. It's really remarkable what you've been able to accomplish in a relatively short amount of time. Where you're able to reach millions of people and inspire them, educate them, and empower them to not only look inwards, but also share outwardly so that they can contribute and live their best lives. And, you know, it's hard not to be impressed by that.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you.
How would you describe your mission?
I think it's all about love, all about positivity, all about sharing this healing with the world. I think that especially in the world today, we see a lot of divide, a lot of people fighting, a lot of hate, a lot of anger, a lot of frustration behind everything, all the chaos that's happening as well. And I think that what the world requires is people to come together, to unite, to get rid of that divide, and also to look inwards, to find their greater calling. I think that a lot of people, because of society and how we're fed through media and conditioning, we get afraid to make mistakes. We get afraid to wander out of the box. And I think that then a lot of people end up doing and living their entire lives doing something they're not enjoying and not really fulfilling any greater mission. So my mission is to help other people realize their mission and then to all come together and come to one realization that our mission on this planet is to come together in love and harmony and in service.
It sounds like we're trying to find purpose, which I hear over and over again. People often struggle with that, especially younger people maybe leaving school and entering the workforce. So like, what is my purpose? What should I be doing? What advice would you give them?
Well, how can a person find purpose if they're not being purposeful? So what I always say to people is, if you find anywhere you can help or be of service, you will feel extremely purposeful in that moment. For example, somebody's washing the dishes, and then you say, hey, I'll wash the dishes for you. While you're washing the dishes, you won't be questioning, what is my purpose in that moment? You know you are serving some purpose already. And I think that the bigger question that people get confused with is not so much like, what am I doing now? It's more so, what is the end goal? Where's all of this leading to? And when it comes to that, it's all about coming back to returning to love. In our spirituality terms, we say returning to love is because if we look at when we first came onto this planet, as a baby, you're curious, you dare wonder, you dare dream. Kids dare have goals and big dreams and desires. And then because of conditioning, we get confined and we get all these fears and doubts. And I think that the process of the spiritual awakening or the seeking is to be able to once again shed those layers and then find their true self, their inner calling again, to be able to be free, be a free spirit. And that is in a vibrant expression of love. And so I feel the end goal will always be fulfillment, will always be happiness, will always be joy, will always be the highest vibrational frequencies. And I think that is found in service, because if you look at even according to human needs psychology, the highest need is the need for contribution. When we contribute beyond ourselves, we are so much happier than even when we do something for ourselves. So service is definitely a big part of purpose. But the reason why most people fail to find their purpose is because, and I remember my master, Grandmaster Akshar, once said this. He said that if you want to find your purpose, first equip yourself. And I used to think, what does that mean? Equip yourself. Equip yourself with what? And what he was meaning was that the more we equip ourselves, the more we will be able to find purpose. Just like, let's say, for example, you were to go into a new workplace, a workspace, and there was an employer. And the employer, and then one day you ask the employer, you say, hey, boss, what's my purpose here? And then the boss will say, well, it depends. What's your skill sets? And you say, well, nothing really. And then he says, nothing? And he said, yeah, nothing really. So what's my purpose? I'm sure your employer will say, I ain't got a purpose for you here. But let's say, for example, if you said, oh, he said, what skill sets do you have? And then you say, I'm good at sales. I'm good at marketing. I'm good at speaking. I'm good at managing. I'm good at creative thinking. I'm good at production. I'm good at motivation. I'm good at leadership. I'm good at all of these things. What is my purpose? The employer will be able to say, there's so many purposes you have in life. You could do so many things. Here's all the different things you can do to become purposeful in this situation. So in the same sense, we need to start equipping ourselves with these human skills so that we can become a bigger contribution to society. And once we equip ourselves with those skills, we will not question, what is my purpose in this world? Because there's almost too much to do.
That's brilliant. I haven't heard it put quite that way before. Let me ask you this. Are we talking about natural talent?
I think that people who have natural talent, then you're blessed with that. That's great. Use it. Wherever you use it, use it. But then I think that being a kid who grew up the shy kid, the introvert, and now being a public speaker that reaches out to millions of people around the world, I know these skills are learnable. I know even being the lazy kid and now being the highly disciplined and with high motivation and drive person switching, I also know even that can be learned. So I think there is no human skill that can't be learned. Even the skill of communication, the skill of confidence, the skill of leadership, the skill of money management, or any of these things, I believe it can all be learned. Yeah,
you certainly have a lot to share with people, and we haven't even gotten into the very tip of that yet. And your teachings are out there, easily found on the internet and social media. You post to YouTube every single day, and then everywhere you speak, you're out there. But I feel like we don't hear much about where you started. And so I'd like to dive into that and start there. Sound good?
You want to get into the dirty part, huh? They say every master was once a disaster.
That's what they say. And so I'm assuming that you had disastrous beginnings also.
Made a ton of mistakes. And right. I think that's a part of the human journey. I think the biggest problem is people fear making the mistake. But from a young age, I think I thrived in those challenging times. Like I get a thrill from it. I get more of a drive when I see that there's challenges happening. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, let's dive into that. What were your earliest memories as a child, as a young Eric Ho?
I think Mom and Dad were very loving. They gave me everything. At least they tried to give me everything. I know that it wasn't easy for them because being coming from Hong Kong, China into UK and not knowing the language and not having the network or the financial means, it was tough. But I know they gave me a lot of love. They tried. They gave me everything. Dad was a in a gang. So dad was a gang leader, which not many people know the story. And in some ways, obviously, there was a lot of hate and anger and frustration when they're in fight mode, street fights and everything that goes on.
What age are we talking about here?
Growing up, actually, from the moment I was a baby, I remember just things used to fly around the house. And when we go out from, I don't know, age 3, 4, 5, we go out to the restaurant, suddenly table will flip and things will throw in and then weapons will be picked up and things will happen. So I think that, it was an interesting childhood. It was an interesting one. And in some ways, I feel that some of the leadership traits that I have today, I believe came from dad, actually, because although one's maybe used for negative and one used for positive, but I feel that leadership trait is similar in the same sense that if you look at even drug dealers out there, they have certain entrepreneurship skills that is, if they were to use in a positive business, let's say,
a legal way,
very well. Yeah, they would do very well. And so, I think there's certain humans. It's human skills. You know, it's that confidence, that no fear action. And so, dad was my idol growing up. So I looked up to him, and I didn't know good or bad when I was growing up, because to me, dad was the coolest guy in town. You know, wherever he goes, there's so many people following him, and everybody's like, you know, literally bowing down at him and saying, you know, so it was, I wanted to be like dad when I was growing up. Yeah.
Did they fear him more than respect him?
I would say so. Yes. Yeah. I would say so. But it's interesting because I believe that because I so wanted to be like dad, that's why that alpha male ego side of me, also was that way. So I wouldn't have liked to be my friend when I was younger because I was not a nice person. Right. I didn't kill anyone, but I was just not a nice person. I think it was always either my way or the highway, you know?
Yeah, well, that's the result of the role model that you were dealing with. Backing up a little bit, were you born in Hong Kong or UK?
I was born in UK, yeah.
Born in the UK. Any brothers or sisters?
I got one brother and two sisters. I'm the eldest. All responsibilities.
Yes.
We get all the responsibilities.
Did you find yourself having to take care of them, or were your parents handling that okay?
I had to cook for them. I had to look after them from maybe 5 till 15, 16. Because mom and dad were always working. They used to have a fish and chip shop. Chinese takeaway also, and we used to live upstairs, and I used to have to look after them. Mum and dad would be working every single day, day and night. Yeah. Hmm.
What did you dream of becoming when you were young?
Aside from a part of me that wanted to be like dad, and the funny thing is, growing up, we used to watch a lot of like Hong Kong gang movies. And I wanted to be that. And I remember every time I say to dad, dad would enjoy it. He'd be like, yes, you should. You know, it's so funny because it's hard to imagine your dad would encourage that. But my mom would be the one who was like, what are you telling your son to do? You know, so I'm glad the mom side was there. Otherwise, that may be my thing right now, you know? So, I think that was a big part of me. I liked fighting. I liked to fight. There was a different side of me, and I don't know where this came from. No, I think it's just maybe a confused child. one day is a friend told me he wanted to be an artist, and I said, okay, I want to be an artist too. But I think I only said that once, and it was shut down straight away. So I didn't go any further with that. Being in an Asian family, mm-hmm. I can either be a doctor, a lawyer or a failure. So it's
like, I understand
anything,
that.
Anything else is a failure. So,
yeah. Right, right. And did you find your entrepreneurship tendencies coming out? Were you like selling cigarettes on the playground for an outrageous amount of money?
No, actually, saying that, my it's a weird thing. Like my mom and dad would have, they were extremely strict, very, very strict. Like I couldn't chew chewing gum until I was like 13 when all the kids were already chewing chewing gum. And then I was always asking, why can I not chew chewing gum? Mom used to always tell me the story that if I chew chewing gum and I swallow it, then I won't grow any taller or something like that. And I don't know what it was, but it's just that it's very dangerous. And I was like, all the kids, I said, Mom, I'm 13. But I used to listen to them. I had a lot of respect for my parents. And they were very strict. So there were certain rules and things, and I couldn't go out. I couldn't take the bus. There's a lot of things I couldn't do. I couldn't go out, play with the other kids and stuff. So no, I think they didn't allow me. They wanted me to study. And my dad said, study first and later on you can be in the gangs, you know, so when you're old enough. And it's interesting because the moment I hit 15, 16, and I think it's the suppression of that control from the parenting. I rebelled. Like I left home when I was 16. Like they didn't agree with it. I literally just disappeared in the middle of the night and never went back home.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where did you go?
When I was 16, I went with some friends to another city, Leeds. We went down south from where we were. And they got me into the party scene. And I experienced that for a couple of days and then a week. And then I stayed there for a week. Mom was saying, are you not coming back yet? I said, oh, okay, I'll come back soon. And the next moment, I don't know what it was. It was just this like, I just felt like I'm done. I'm done with school. I'm done with living at home. I don't want to be there anymore. There's no freedom there. Literally, I said, okay, Mom, I'm coming back. I'm coming back. So I went back literally 2 weeks later in the evening, in the night. And I remember Mom was there. I got home and Mom says, oh, you're finally home. You finally remember where home is. And I said, yeah. I went to the room. I started packing my things. And I said, and she said, where are you going? I said, I'm leaving. She said, what do you mean you're leaving? I said, I'm done. I'm leaving. I don't want to be here anymore. She said, where are you going? And then she was crying. I packed it in the car and I drove back down to Leeds and I disappeared. And I started living with my friends and rented a house and started working in a trailer van selling burgers. So it was, yeah, it was a weird one. Like, I can only say now that maybe the universe had different plans for me and some energy came through me to make me really want to do that at that time. Yeah.
Did you bring any of those gang ambitions with you when you left home?
I never joined a gang, and I think because the opportunity for some reason didn't present itself.
Lucky you.
But at college, I did. I was in a lot of fights, and I used to rally people together on my side to fight. I don't know why it felt. Well, it's ego. Mm-hmm. It was for sure ego. It was my upbringing. Whenever there's anybody fighting, I would have, even if it's got nothing to do with me, I would have to go in and be that righteous person to say, who are you fighting this person? And you should not bully this person. And I would, but in a sense, I guess that was justifying why I would beat somebody else up, but we would beat them up bad, which is not really what you should be doing at all, you know? So it's like,
the punishment didn't fit the crime?
No. I think it was observing it growing up and feeling very connected to how dad used to feel, that sense of power and wanting that. And the interesting thing is the more you feed that ego, the more powerful you feel you are. And the more times you win a fight, and this is what I teach today. I say when a lot of the times when we win a fight, you don't really win. You never win. Because when you win a fight, you lose your ego. And so when you win a fight, your ego becomes twice as strong every time. And it becomes so strong, so vicious, that sometimes it feels like it's uncontrollable.
Often when we're young, that school age, young men, like we all do, we need to release that aggressiveness somehow. And most of the time we go to competitive sports, like I did. Did you play any sports?
I played some sports, yeah. I think actually what you're saying is right. But that word competitive, now you say it, it's connecting everything for me right now. Because I feel like I'm that right now.
Competitive?
I feel so.
Who are you competing with?
I feel I'm competing with myself every day to become better. I feel like I'm competing in every game I play. I feel like I'm competitive. So I give my best. I give my all in everything that I do, including last night we were playing basketball. I feel the same thing. I would give it my all. And it doesn't matter which thing I do, whether it's yoga now, or whether whether it's the speaking journey, or whether it's the YouTube game, or anything. I think one thing that I did learn from Dad was that he said, "Whatever you do, be the best at it." And I guess in some ways, it's that stubbornness, maybe, is a success trait if used in the right direction, I guess.
Yeah. So in a way, he was a positive role model. You just have to channel it.
Very. My dad was very hardworking. Everything he did, he was very hardworking. Yeah. Actually, he left the gangs when I was five already. He tried to leave. Some big problems happened, and then 9, 10 again. He tried to leave, and then roughly when I was around 13, he was completely out, done. So, but my dad is completely changed. Like if you looked at him today, everyone says he looks like the laughing Buddha. He's just smiling every day and very happy. Yeah,
yeah. I met him. He's so joyous and just like a big teddy bear. Well, that's amazing. You know, age tends to slow you down, also.
Some people.
Yeah, some people, right. Mm-hmm. Well, looking back, were there any signs that might have indicated that you'd end up doing what you do today?
I think I never really thought much into this. But now that we're having this conversation, and while we're having this conversation, it all links up. It all adds up. I feel leading people or guiding people, being the spokesperson, these things are the traits that my dad was doing, you know? And maybe some of the actions were not the best, what he did in the past, but there was a lot of power there. He was successful in what he did, you know? And so I feel that a lot of those things, they connect, all the dots connect. And I think that a big part of whether it is mom and dad, deep down inside, my dad is a very giving person. Like, it doesn't matter these gangs or whatever's happening, anytime we'll pass any homeless people or anything, he'll always say, give them money or help them, or we need to help them, or any charity, he'll always be donating. Even when we didn't have money growing up, both my parents were very giving. They would like helping people and giving, helping the less fortunate. And they used to always teach me to do that as well growing up. They used to give me money and say, give it to that person over there. So I think that because of maybe the struggles of his upbringing and how some things planned out for him and how different opportunities arise for him, then he went down the wrong route. But then I think deep down inside, they had that trait. And give it another, let's say, if my dad got to go again and he didn't choose that route, I would probably see my dad doing something similar to what I'm doing, you know? And so I think it all connects. And in fact, I know it all connects, yeah.
What was his upbringing?
Poverty. Poverty. They grew up, they were on rice farms. So very little money. There were a lot of them. I think their uncles and aunties, his brothers and sisters, there were probably 7, 8, 9 of them or something like that. And he used to always share these stories how they used to just share one bun between 9 of them and have a little bite each a day or something like that, you know? And so it was tough. It was tough for sure. But the interesting thing is my dad, amongst all his siblings, he became the most successful. I mean, even when he was doing the gangs, or after he was doing the gangs, he went into restaurant business, like a real business, legal business. he became very successful doing it. And I think that observing his hard work and observing how he was and observing how he looked after the whole family it really inspired me. And so today I became that person who now is providing for the family and giving back to them and allowing them to enjoy the rest of their years in this world, you know?
Yeah, how wonderful is that? They must be so proud of you.
They are now. They were not when I left home, and they were not when I rebelled. They were not when I decided to do all of the things that they couldn't see for me, you know? Even starting my first business, quitting school, quitting college, going into recycling business, doing different businesses. I think sometimes they would question, can you really do this? You, can you really do it? You know, they would challenge, they would question. But it's only because I know they love and I know they care. It's just because of what they know. And if they don't know, then it's very hard for them to support. But today they are the proudest parents. So that's why a lot of the time people say to me, they say, I have some goals, I have some dreams, but, you know, it's not that easy. I say, why is it not easy? They say, oh, because my family's not supportive and this person's not supportive. And I always say to people, I say, actually, it doesn't matter who's supportive, who's not supportive, because through my journey, I don't believe that it was full support in everything that I did or everything that I chose. I don't believe it was there also. But at the end of the day, you need to understand if it's your loved ones who are not supporting you, the root of it must be because they love you, they care for you, they want the best for you, but they don't know otherwise. They don't know that is an option for you. And so what I always say to people is that it's not about making the right decisions in life. It's about your ability to make a decision, then make that decision right. Because whether leaving home was at 16 was a right or wrong, we don't need to have that conversation right now. Whether being in fights, whether working in a burger van, whether taking out a $460,000 loan when I was 21 to start my first business, whether that was stupid or whether that was right or wrong, actually nobody needs to judge that right now. Because at the end of the day, I took the step. I took the step because I felt it. And when I took the step, I decided that I'm going to make this work. Whatever step I take, I make sure that I make it work. And as a result of it, now, many years later, I've made the things work. And what's the result? Because mom and dad know that I'm safe, not only safe, I have this abundance to be able to not only look after myself, but look after them and help people around the world. And that's all they ever dreamed of. And so I think sometimes it's not required to have the people around you support you. It doesn't matter. If if you want something enough, then you go for it. You go all in. You make sure to make it happen, make it work. Yes, you'll face challenges, but if you keep moving and if you keep staying solution focused, you'll get there, you know?
And you're thriving today. And rarely have I spoken to a successful person. Well, I don't think I've ever run into one who had a straight path and it was all good. There's always zigzags and adversity and failures. That's just part of the deal if you want to get to that level. And surely your experience was no different. But regarding support, you had mentioned that early on they would criticize you or question your decisions. Are you the type of person who is more driven by that? By doubting you, that drives some people even more. Was that the case?
I think it was the case. It's interesting because so many people talk so much about parenting and say, and they say, okay, if a kid turns out this way, it must be all down to parenting. And while there is nature and while there is nurture, and they do play a part and a role, but what I also observed was that me, my brother, and my sisters went through the same upbringing and the same conditioning. But we turned out very differently. And what I realized was my dad had this, because of the way he spoke, whatever you do, it's never good enough. Whatever you do, he will always say, look at your cousin Joe, or look at this person, or look at that person. Look how confident they are. Look at why are you not like that? And what I found was some of my siblings actually went a different direction in saying that, being upset and saying, dad doesn't love me. Whatever I do, dad always thinks I'm not good enough. But dad did the same thing to me, you see? But whenever he did that, I knew that was his way. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but he wants, which mom and dad doesn't want the best, right? So he wants the best for you, but his way is to try and stimulate you. Like he wants to push you that way. And so I was stimulated. Yeah. Mm. So in exactly what you're saying there, whenever people challenge me or say that I don't think you can do it or it's not possible, I get a thrill from that. I feel like, okay, game on, you know?
Right. Well, it's true then that it's really not the adversity, it's how you respond to it. And
yeah,
so
it's
early
your perspective on it. Huh?
Right. It's perspective. And early on, you developed that mindset from somewhere to shift that focus and have the more empowering perspective on the situation and what he was trying to relay to you. At the time, did you realize that he was doing this out of love?
I don't think so. I didn't used to think that much. I think I used to get a little bit frustrated at times that he would say those things. But for some reason, like I said, naturally that frustration gave me more drive, you know? Yes.
Well, you left home and somehow you ended up in university, although you dropped out later. I don't think that's common with people who leave home so early. They go to the workforce and whether through necessity or otherwise, they end up skipping that.
Actually, not many people know this story, but my college or university day was not, it was for fun. It was not, I didn't do anything with it. So I didn't get any qualifications or anything. I used to go in to meet people. That's all. Yeah.
So you weren't going after the degree. You just
I was not. I didn't know. No, I because I was so much in work at the time, I worked in trailer vans flipping burgers for around five years. Yeah, living in tents and trailers like a gypsies, that type of lifestyle for around 4 or 5 years. And I was used to earning money. I was used to being able to look after myself and buy things for myself. So university or college was nothing. It was just that all my friends were there and my friends through growing up were there, and people my age group were there. And I felt like I can only meet people my age group in university or college. So I used to go in some Mondays and some Fridays.
And never miss a party.
Never miss a party, yeah.
Right.
But I used to go in. Actually, I was a very bad college student. I was a very bad college student. All the lecturers, they would know. Every time I would go into the lecture theater, I would gather a few people up. And I'll say, hey, let's go for a drink. So half the class would go, because I was the first person to have a car and be able to drive, you see. So I used to just take people out of university. So that was my purpose there.
You troublemaker, you.
Something like that, yeah.
And so you ended up in some pretty lucrative businesses. How did you go from dropping out of college to making millions of dollars in your own businesses?
Yeah, I think, first of all, the restaurant business was standard for me because I grew up in it and I observed Dad how he did it. So I just modeled and it made money. It made a good amount of money. And then I got bored. And then somebody approached me with a steel recycling business. And I had no idea what it was, but I thought, wow, I'm 24. Never thought steel recycling. Imagine going out telling people I have a steel business. It was an ego thing, you know. I just thought it sounds pretty sexy, you know. It's like this Chinese kid doesn't need to just open Chinese restaurants anymore, you know. So I did it just for fun, really. And I didn't know that by using the same attitude and the same drive towards a total different thing that I had no idea what it was about. And that eagerness to win and strike that deal, I struck that deal. In 5 months, we struck the biggest recycling deal in the UK, actually, for rubber and steel, which was 46,000 tons. And I got, I think it was around $15 million at that time. And I was just, I think, 24, pushing 25 years old. So that was a lot of money for a 24-year-old and who didn't know what else to do with it apart from party. So you can imagine how much alcohol I had to consume to try and use that money, you know. It wasn't so good for the body.
Wow. And were you still an angry kid?
The angry kid became an angry boss, huh? So I took that character still into business also. So when people didn't do things, then I would shout. And occasionally, when things get a little bit messier, then there will be fist fights. Yeah, which is, doesn't, like even right now when I'm speaking about it, it feels like I'm speaking about somebody else, because it's like, why would anybody do that, you know, in an office space? It's like me and you here. Imagine you say, the camera's off. I say, no, it should be this way. And then we fall out and I start punching you. You know, it's just like, I just right now when I think about it, I'm just like, what on earth was wrong with this person, you know? But yeah. I guess that's what I grew up in, you know?
Leadership by fear then, huh?
Yeah, like that. Yeah, hard management. Yeah.
Well, you are a different person today. Was there a moment in your life when you recognized that you were headed down a dark path and needed to reevaluate?
Yeah, I think it was the steel business. There was a guy called Vincent. He used to work for me in the steel business. And we had rubber casings that came from the tires. And one of the months, our manager reported to us that a lot of the rubber casings were missing. And then we found out that Vincent had been selling it under the table and not putting it on the accounts. And we calculated it to, every month he was taking around £30,000 a month for the past like 5-6 months without telling us, and he was shifting it into his own account. When we found that out, obviously I got very upset and angry. And so I remember messaging Vincent, and I said, and it's interesting because I thought I had grown out of the fighting. At that time, I was already extremely calm in typing this message. I typed the message to Vincent. I said, I know what you've done. Just pack your things. Just go back to China. And let's just just end our partnership here. I felt that was already very tame, very, it wasn't so aggressive. Then he responded with, "What do you mean? You can't just get me to leave. I'm a partner in the business." And because there was so much already in there and there was so much disappointment and anger, I replied, I said, "What are you talking about? I can't do that." I said, "I can do anything I want to do." And I said, "You know what you've done and you dare do that. And at the same time, tell me that you're staying in this partnership." Then he messages me. He says, "You can't just throw me out like this. I know where you live." Now you never, you challenging somebody who is very aggressive in nature with a, "I know where you live." My ego didn't like that. You get what I'm saying at that time? So I remember that feeling. It was like, what is that supposed to mean? You get what I'm saying? You know where I live? I messaged him back with a few F words and S words and things. And I said, "You know where I live?" I said, "I know where you live. I know where your family lives. I know where everyone lives in China. I know where they all live." I said, "If you don't get your ass to the office in 10 minutes time," I said, "I'm going to find you. I'm going to find your family. And you're going to be sorry and you're going to regret this." Imagine those were my words. Sent that out. And I remember I rushed straight to the office. I rushed to the office. And I remember there's a guy on our team. He's still on our team today. His name's Steve. He's the nicest, genuine guy you would ever meet. And I said to Tommy, I said to Cheryl, I said to Grace, I said to a few of our team members when I got to the office, I said, "Guys, get Steve. Go to the bar across the road, get out of this office now." And then they were like, what's up? I said, "Shit's going to go down here." I said, "Pack all your stuff, take Steve." I was so afraid of Steve seeing me this way. And it was a really interesting thing. I said, "Get Steve, pack your stuff, go out now, go move." So they start packing their stuff there. "Steve, we're going to the bar across the road." Then on the way to the door, Vincent walks through the door. I don't know what happened. Something else took over. Ego took over. The big ego took over. And I was just, it was all fists everywhere, flying everywhere, all over him. And then suddenly he's on the ground, his glass were on the floor. I stamp on his glasses and kicking his face and punching and everything. And there's blood and everything. And this all goes crazy. Then suddenly I see I'm just hitting him. And I remember recalling Steve was saying, "Don't, stop it. You're going to kill him. Stop it." And everyone was shouting and I couldn't control myself. It's just in that moment. And then I remember some lady had come this way and I just couldn't see some shadow. Someone was pushing me. Then I pushed this way. Then suddenly I hear a scream. And then I look behind me and I see Vincent's pregnant wife lying on the floor, holding her stomach and crying. And I realized that I had just pushed the wife onto the floor. And so when I seen that, suddenly it's almost like everything just stopped. Like everything just went quiet. And I was looking, and while this time was happening, I remember it was like the observer just thinking, what is wrong with you? Why are you so crazy? Why do you need to be like this? What is wrong with you? You know, and all these emotions were coming out, and I started crying, and my hands were shaking, everything was shaking, and I was just like, I don't know what I'm doing. I really don't know what I'm doing. Then we went to look after her. Took her to the doctors, the hospital, and everything was okay. Kid is nice and safe, and everything. I think that was a big moment for me. It was a huge moment where I was observing the animal, the the beast, the creature, whatever that was, I observed it for the first time, almost like in third person, and I said, no more. Nobody should be that way. Nobody deserves to be beaten that way, and what is wrong with this, you know? So I think I took a good few months out. Some people can call it suffering from some mild form of depression or something like that, but I was questioning everything, questioning my life, questioning how I was with my past friends or past relationships or anything, because, and then it, everything just came back to feeling that I was a really bad person. And I think I had months of that depression and crying and realization. So I think that was a very big determining factor and crucial moment in this timeline, because after that, I never had a fight ever again. Mm. You know, that was when I was 25 or 26. Yeah,
that's incredible, that story. Thanks for sharing. What is the decision that you ultimately came to?
I think it's just that no more. I cannot be like that anymore. So I think I stopped feeding the ego. It would come up at times. Somebody would do something wrong and it'd come up. I'd recognize it and I'll find a different perspective and say, oh, it's okay. Don't worry about it. Mm. And I realize now, because we always say, what you focus on expands. So if you give something energy, it feeds off it. But if you don't give it energy, it needs to find somewhere else to go. And I believe now, like many years later, 10 plus years later, the ego's gone somewhere else, you know, because I no longer feed it. I don't allow for it. Mm. I don't fight. I haven't had a fight for that many years. I don't get upset. I don't get angry. And that also got me into spirituality on breath work, breathing, keeping mind calm and staying in peace and love. And that's why I teach that today. Yeah. You know, people say you can turn your mess into your message. So
was that breath work, meditation, the spirituality part of that transformation from being the angry, violent person to the more peaceful person that you are now?
It was a big part of it, yes. Yeah.
And did you seek out mentors to coach you through that, or did you discover this on your own?
I think I did. I did seek out mentors and coaches. Actually, I when I went to China on business trips, I used to go to the temples a lot, and I used to speak to a lot of the monks, and I used to ask them a lot of these questions. What is our purpose in life? And why are some people angry? Or why do people fight? Or how do you stop fighting? Or how do you stay in peace? Or how do you keep your mind calm? And how do you not become stressed? And I used to ask a lot of these questions. And I think that through their wisdom and teachings, then I would slowly, slowly get myself into what we call spirituality.
Did you understand their answers right off?
I think, as humans, we always feel like we understand people's answers until a few years later where we understand the same answer again and you have another aha moment or paradigm shift over the same quote or same knowledge. So I felt like I did, but I know that every year, as years have passed by, it's a huge progression.
So along that journey, you started creating content and putting it online around spirituality and law of attraction and these sort of things. What led you to that?
I think all I initially wanted was just to share what I learned, share what I've been through, what I've learned from my coaches, my mentors, and things that have helped change my life, you know? All I wanted to do was share these things with people. And I didn't really know that it was going to accumulate to over 100 million views and all this, you know? So I think that, like they always say, you know, man makes his plan and God has his plan for you. So I think that the universe has bigger plans for me, yeah.
You used to be branded as the yogi with the Lamborghini. Now, that could appear incongruent with spirituality as some people see it. How would you address that?
I think that the biggest problem I see is that there is a big divide between people who say they are spiritual and people who are stuck in the physical. And I think there's a big divide. But we are all here in spirit, in physical. So I don't understand why people have this fight so much in, hey, you're spiritual, you shouldn't have nice things. It's like, well, what do you mean? I'm supposed to have horrible things because I'm spiritual? No, but you're not supposed to use money. So I'm supposed to use what? Just use love? Like, do you see, you know? Because I think people, they question this money thing. And I think it's just a conditioning, because if we say money is the root of all, we can already finish the sentence, because we've been conditioned that way. Although we don't want to think that way, it's in our brains. And because of that, people do really actually believe that money is the root of all evil and money is bad. But I think, like anything in life, money doesn't hold a good or bad energy. In good hands, it can be used for charity and to save lives. That's what we do. We have our nonprofit out in Kenya. In bad hands, it can be used for bad, you know, but just like everything else in life. So people who say that money isn't important, I always challenge them. I say, the food you ate today, that wasn't a result of money. The house you live in, that's not the result of money. People use money, you see. We live in a money world. So I think when I did that, it took a lot of courage, actually, to make that point. Yogi with a Lamborghini. Because when you put a big message out there, which is so controversy, there's going to be backlash for sure. Like, the people will either, there will be 50% of the people which will agree with you and say, oh my God, that's what I've been trying to tell the world. And then I've got the 50% keen haters who are like, you're not a real yogi. You drive a Lamborghini. And it's like, whoa. You see? So I think the only reason we branded it that way is because we want to get the message out there. We want to awaken spiritual people, because how I see it is like this. I see there's a lot of people out there chasing for money, and they don't know why they're chasing for money. They're addicted, just like I was at one point, chasing and thinking that more money would equal success or fame or happiness or whatever it equals. But it never happens. You make more and more money, it doesn't make you any happier. And then I see the other side of the spectrum, where people are like, oh, spiritual and namaste and breathing, breathing, breathing and meditation. But deep down inside, they're stuck. I know a lot of them are stuck in the physical. They're great in meditation, because meditation, you can go anywhere. You'd be up there with the clouds, you know, all day. But the moment they open their eyes, they're back in their house. They're back with their opening up the envelopes and seeing the bills they need to pay and thinking, how on earth am I going to pay this month? So nobody can tell me, no spiritual person can tell me, that when they open up those red letters, their vibrational frequency is full of love and positivity. No way. So does money affect your vibration? Yes, it does also. The lack of money does. So when people say money is the root of all evil, I always say to people, what about the lack of money? Isn't the lack of money the root of all evil? If you think of what people do when they lack money these days, people can kill.
That's a great point.
People steal. And so I think that my point is, if I can be loud enough with that point, if I can use my vulnerability and allow 50% of the market to slam me on this, it's okay, because at least I made my statement. Yogi in Lamborghini, the idea behind that is I want to bridge the gap. I want to awaken the spiritual people that you are living in a physical world. It's okay to live in more comfort, and it's okay to have abundance. I want to awaken the entrepreneur people to say there's purpose. There's a yogi side. There's a meditation side. That's where happiness is. And I want to bridge that gap, because I believe that is what we're lacking in this world. I believe there's too much divide. I believe if we bridge that gap and we have more unity, people come together in love and service, but then they also can take care of themselves. I believe if we can fuel and educate the spiritual people with wealth knowledge, I believe we have consciouspreneurs, wealth yogis. I believe these people are going to be the people who can change the world, because they'll have the capacity to do so. They'll have the finances to do so. They'll have the freedom to do so also.
That's deceptively brilliant to me, because the way you're able to bridge the gap and get that message out there that is unique to a lot of spiritual leaders and people in the space. Only a couple years ago, you undertook a spiritual journey that resulted in a pretty significant reinvention of your brand and the way you show up. Tell me about that journey.
I was approached by a disciple of Grandmaster Aksha, who is a Himalayan yogi. And she messaged me and asked me to go to the Himalayas with Grandmaster. And I said, what is this for? And she said, Grandmaster would like to give you the blessing to be his first disciple to receive the title of spiritual master. And I remember when I first seen that message, I was in Taiwan, I was doing a gig out there at the time, and I thought, spiritual master? Like, me, spiritual master? I said, not quite sure about spiritual master, because I always brand myself as the spiritual gangster, you know? It's the yogi with the Lamborghini. And I think there was a few questions that happened there. And then she explained that it's for some training. You go into the mountains, 30 days, meditation, some yoga practice, and there'll be some initiations. I think I was curious about what is initiations, you know, what does that mean? What is all this mystical world, you know, these mystical terms? So I said yes, and I went up there.
You get jumped in by a bunch of monks.
Yeah. So I didn't know what was going to happen. And then what happened was I went there. Day one of the training was hardcore yoga. I was almost thinking like, I want to go home. I don't want to continue this because it's very tough. Day two was even more of it. I was thinking it's extremely tough. I don't know if I can handle this. Day three, we sat down and he was doing these practices with third eye with me. And then he lit some candles and lights and this in the yoga room. And then we started doing some chants. And then he told me to close my eyes and then follow his guidance. I followed his guidance. He said, okay, now you should see a light. Can you see it? And I said, well, if imagining light means seeing light, then I guess I can imagine a light. And he said, what about now? This extremely, extremely bright light just comes in. Really, really bright. So bright, I feel like somebody's like, almost like, imagine grabbing one of these lights and putting right in front of your face with your eyes closed. It felt like, who's doing that? So it shocked me. I opened my eyes straight away and I realized Grandmaster sat on the other side of the room with his eyes closed in meditation. I said, I seen it. He still had his eyes closed. He said, yes. I said, was that my third eye open? I opened my third eye. And then he said, well, I opened it for you this time, but in future, you need to learn how to open it. In my mind, the skepticism came in. I was thinking, he's got some torch or something like that, or something. Where did that light come from? I was checking out the windows. Where's the sun coming in? And it's like, that doesn't make sense. That felt, it was not just a light. I felt just this big surge of energy. And it shocked me so much. And I thought, it shocked me so much I came out of it. I didn't even get to experience it fully, you know? And then that was the end of that day. Day four, we would go in. Day five, we'll go in. Deeper dimensions, deeper practices. And we'll be spending a lot of our time training in a different dimension, being able to see past life, future life, other dimensions, other existences, everything over the next 30 days of this journey while we do this pilgrimage, this journey to mastery, through the mountains, through the Himalayas, and through different parts of the of India, receiving powers. It's very difficult to gather that up in a sentence to say what the experience was, but we did film a documentary on it, and we're right now pitching for Netflix. So hopefully when that comes out, then everybody will actually see the journey, because it was the most craziest awakening journey ever, where you see everything. You see your purpose. You see why everything happened. You see your past life. You see everybody else's past life and future life. And you see what the world is coming to. You see the universe. You see everything like that.
Wow. So, and that sounds amazing. I think the world needs to see that. What do you mean when you say traveling through different dimensions?
I think the easiest way for people to understand it is, let's say, for example, when you're sleeping. So you're made up of energy, right?
Yes.
That's in agreement. So when you're sleeping, where would you say your energy was? The distribution of your energy. Would you say thought? Would you say that was energy?
Thought. I suppose so. Thoughts are your energy.
If your thoughts go towards somewhere, let's say, for example, if you visualize right now that you're in the Bahamas, right? Would some of your energy distribution be in the Bahamas?
I suppose it would.
Right, it would be there. Okay. So if your energy distribution is in the Bahamas, are you there or are you not there? So I'm not asking
part
about
physical.
So I'm not asking about physical. We all know your physical is here, right? I'm asking just you as an energy source, which is beyond this physical. Are you actually in Bahamas when you visualize you're in Bahamas?
Part of you anyway.
Yeah, so part of your energy is there. So in that same sense, when we are asleep, we are definitely not here. Somebody can go in your room, grab something, and go out. You wouldn't even know. You're not here. So your energy must be somewhere else. Now, if I ask, where was your energy? You say, sleeping? What does that mean? Because it's either here or somewhere else. It must be somewhere. It's doing something. It's dormant? No, energy doesn't. Energy, you think energy just goes to sleep? Energy doesn't go to sleep. Energy is always moving. It's always moving. And so it's somewhere else in different dimension. Mm. And then people will question, they'll say, what do you mean different dimension? Well, whether you call it sleep dimension or dream dimension, there's very interesting things. Have you ever had that moment before where you wake up in the morning and then you really enjoyed the dream and you're like, oh my God, that was such a good dream. What happened again?
And you forgot it.
1, 2, 3 seconds, it disappears. Why does that happen?
Tell me.
We'll be here for another 6 hours if we have this conversation. But because there's permissions going in and out of, like, have you ever watched the movie Avatar?
Yes.
It's like that. There's different permissions. If you pull a plug on one side, then you enter into a different side. So we're multidimensional beings. So we're in different dimensions. And what people don't realize is that what we do in a different dimension affects our reality in this dimension also. And by the way, it's not so far-fetched to understand that time works differently in different dimensions. Because even if we talk about Mars, if you go out there, time works differently already. So this is already science. That's already a different dimension. It's a different space, you know? And also, how does outer dimension affect inner dimension? This is the core of our teachings today. When we teach manifestation, we don't just teach law of attraction, how people know it. We are teaching people how to access deeper dimensions through awakening, moving your energy somewhere else, making a tweak there to manifest in this reality, which manifests 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times faster. And people will question how. Well, in outer dimensions, when small changes happen, big changes happen in inner dimension. A good example of that would be if we have two tectonic plates just touch each other on the edge, just touch each other. Here we have chaos, big chaos, right? Earthquake, right? So we have big problems here. Small things outside, big changes inside. We use a different dimension understanding. Let's take a vodka shot. Down a vodka shot, small, small thing. Outside, guess what's happening inside? Your cells are dying. You'll be killing some cells there, you see? So cells are having they're having a tsunami. They're having an earthquake down there. And they don't know what happened, right? Small thing here, big changes in there. You take a glass of alkali water, down a big bottle of alkali water. What happens? Alkalizes, flushes all the toxins, everything. Inside is having a party. So small things outside, big changes inside. If one can go into deep meditation, taking the energy outwards and make small changes outside, actually, they will find manifestations in this human form. Money, relationship, love. Happiness, so easy. Mm. Very easy.
Did you ever experience a time warp when you were in your training in the Himalayas, and can you replicate that now?
Yeah, we're doing it all the time. Yeah. So, my biggest realization every time I came back into physical form, and I'm saying that you're probably thinking, "What do you mean coming back in physical?" Is because if you watch a documentary, you'll see that most of the 30 days, my eyes were closed. It's because we're in meditation, we're somewhere else. But the interesting thing is, my observation in this physical reality would be one day, Grandmaster would say something like, "Okay, place this right leg over right shoulder," and I'll be like stressing out trying to pull it there. Then we'll be training in different dimension. The next morning, we'll wake up and he'll say, "Okay, right leg, right shoulder." I'll be lifting up and just go there. And I'll be like, "Wait there. That doesn't make sense." You know? So when I started to realize that, wow, it means that all the trainings we do outside and how it just affects this side so much faster. Like, I could be closing my eyes, going somewhere else, and then training for two weeks of training, and I come back here, I open my eyes, it's been 5 to 20 minutes. And then you'll see exceptional difference in my skill set, whether I play basketball, our team always laughs about it, because whatever new sport we take on, and then the next day I come back 10 times stronger, and they're like, "Have you been training in different dimension again?" You know, But this is how it works. And the reason why it works that way is because time works differently in different dimension.
Yeah. I see. That's fascinating. Yeah, we could talk about that forever, but we don't have the time right now.
Well, one thing I'd like to mention, though, which was a big experiment for me, and I didn't believe this at first. Well, I guess half believed it, but with skeptical mind, obviously, as a human being. Grandmaster, he eats a lot of food, like a lot of food. I'm talking about heavy curries and chapatis and all these the carbs and everything, right? Like just before he sleeps and all day long, really big meals, right? And if you see him, you wouldn't think that he ate a lot. And it was somebody who questioned, I think one of the students questioned one of the days, it's like, "How do you eat so much and not put on weight?" And he said, "Well, we train in a different dimension." He says, "So we can never get fat." And I was like, "That's so cool." Because through growing up, I've always had a slower metabolism. I always find that I had to work 10 times harder than anybody else to lose weight. And so after this mountain trip, I thought I'd test this theory. And for the last 2 years, if you ask any of my team members, I'm snacking all day long, chocolates and food and whatever, meals and whatever. I eat more than I eat all day long. And I've been testing this theory, and I've been able to eat everything, all ice cream. There's no restriction. There's no holding back. I just eat whatever I want to eat, and been maintaining this weight all the way through. And I've realized how, like, literally you can manifest anything, like, so much faster in different dimension.
So how do you account for being able to eat as much as you want and not put on weight?
Because you need to be doing the work in different dimensions.
Oh, I see. So you're burning the calories somewhere else.
For only 5 minutes, then at least I've done 2 weeks of work here. You get what I'm saying?
Ah, I see.
Because time is different. So it's like if you traveled to Mars and worked out and came back, it's the same. Time is different.
You had mentioned a word, disciple, when you were explaining this journey. What is the difference between master and disciple versus, teacher, say, coach or teacher and student or mentee?
That's a very good question. Yeah. So disciple will not question what master has to say, because full trust and faith is there. It's a knowing. It's a very strong relationship. So whatever grandmaster says, do this, do this, do that. Don't do this. Change your logo. Don't wear this color. It's done. There'll be no questions. There's no question. There's no point in question. Because the disciple knows that the master knows. So this is how disciple is fully respecting and fully flowing with what master's commands are. It's actually much easier for the disciple. It's a much easier journey. You see, I always say that sometimes you can have a goal let's say the destination is the goal. And then what will happen is sometimes some people will ask you, how do you get to the goal? You say, well, here's the vehicle, here's a car, get in the car, drive there, this is how to drive, hit the accelerator, and then you get there, follow the GPS. Some students, they will go into the car and then they'll hit the accelerator, they'll go to the, just as you said, they'll do that. That's what a disciple does. But some students, they are the ones who say, this car? Oh, wow. Okay, so hit the accelerator, yes? You say, yes. How does the engine work, by the way? You're like, what do you mean? Yeah, so how does it work? Like, what's it made from? I don't know, but it doesn't matter, does it? But what's it made from, you know? How does the tires work? So they'll question. Mm. But disciple has no question because he, she knows that master knows what direction they want to go in. When they give command, it's going to take them that because full trust is there. The relationship is very strong. Another reason why discipleship is different is that because if we look at master seeing, having a higher level of consciousness than disciple or student. If somebody, they come up to me, they ask me a question. Let's say, for example, they say, how do I grow a YouTube channel? If it was a student asking, I would say, okay, to grow a YouTube channel, do this, and add this strategy, and you'll be done. Okay, so do that. They'll be like, okay. If a disciple asked the question, how do I start a YouTube channel? I would first observe to see what is the path of this person. I would say, is this person supposed to be doing a YouTube channel right now? Or is it just distraction? What I could say to a disciple is, you shouldn't do a YouTube channel. Do this instead. Then disciple will have no questions to say, okay, because he, she knows that this is not the time for YouTube for them. Otherwise, master would give them the shortcut, will give them the easiest path. So we will not give that because we become responsible though. So responsibility is extremely high for master. Just like a year ago, one of our disciples, we were actually 2 years ago in a Bali trip, in a retreat we had. He came to me. He said, "Okay, I know I want to be. I know I want to go through this journey of being a speaker. But you know, I've got a high-paying job. It's doing this, and you know, what should I do next?" And I said, "Well, it depends who is asking the question." And he knew what I meant at that time. He said, "I'm talking from a disciple point of view. I'm asking the question." I said, "Okay." I said, "Just go back to Miami and quit your job. Book your tickets to the UK. Come over and I'll show you how to go through this journey." Interesting response was, imagine this person's got $140,000 a year job, been there for 11 years or something. So he looks at me, says, "So quit my job, go back to Miami, quit my job?" I said, "Yeah." He said, like now? I said, "Yes." He said, "Okay." I know it was hard for him to swallow at that time. I know, because in his mind is obviously going wild at this time. What am I going to do next? What's my income going to come in? What's going to happen? Will it work? Will it not? But disciple has no question, because disciple has trust in knowing that master knows. So what I'm saying is, at the same time, master is not just giving these commands to, "Oh yes, okay, you do this. Responsibility is there, is it not? Mm. So what happens if this person next day is living on streets, who's going to be accountable, right? Master has to be accountable. So people think master goes out, just gather up disciples. Actually, You gather up loads of disciples, you gather up more responsibility. Who wants to take that on? You get what I'm saying? I'd much rather you just ask me the YouTube question and I answer you how to set up a YouTube channel. But if I look into your destiny and I see that, hey, your YouTube channel isn't going to grow in the next year, in the next 2 years, because you're missing so many different parts. You should be doing something else first. That's your shortcut. Then I would just suggest, don't do the YouTube channel. Do this instead. And sometimes it's very tedious practice, because the do this instead could be practice speaking every day by yourself, you know? It's tedious. Not many people can keep up with that discipline. But if you really trust Master, then you know Master will tell you when the time is right. But when Master tells you the time is right, it happens in that moment. Mm. Yeah. When Master says, now set up your YouTube channel, it goes. Lucy was one of those people. Really? Lucy, you see her? Now she's got 100,000 subscribers. It grew in the last few months just like that. She said, what should I do? I said, don't do this. Cut this part. Focus on this. Now's your time. She does it within a few months. Her YouTube goes crazy.
Yeah. Wow. So really, this is about the mastering having some sort of a foresight. They can actually see what the result will be, as opposed to a teacher or a coach. They're just giving general advice based on what's worked in the past, perhaps.
So I can only speak on behalf of our lineage and our trainings, because today everybody outside, there's this master, that master. So so I can only speak on our lineage, our training, our relationship in our lineage. This is how it works. Yes.
Being a disciple, did your master ask you or require you to change your name?
It was not a requirement. Yeah. I seen it. In different dimension, I seen it. I seen the path of Eric Ho. I seen the path of Master Sri Akashana with the energy. So the instructions were given in different dimension, not necessarily from Grandmaster Aksha. He would translate some message to me also. So it's not required, we can say it's more a requirement from the universe for what is needed to be done, because I think I briefly shared this with you one time about the plane journey to Taiwan and Harriet asking me, what is my purpose in life? This was before the mastery journey. And she asked me, what's my purpose? What's my goal? I said, I don't have any goals. She said, what do you mean? I said, I don't know what it is. Now I feel like my life's going to end soon. And then everyone got really upset. You know, the whole team got really upset thinking, what do you mean your life's going to end soon? I said, I don't know what it is. I just got this feeling. I'm not depressed. I'm not stressed. I'm extremely happy and grateful. And I'm living my purpose. But I just feel like I'm done in this world. I really feel like I'm done, like happy done. I feel like I'm going to transcend or something. I feel like the universe is going to, God is going to call me back or something. I don't know what it is, but I just feel that way. So I don't have any more goals. I feel like I've lived a life that everybody else would have ever dreamed of, you know? And this was a few years ago. And it's so funny because I could only connect that dot after this journey, because literally 2 months after that plane journey was when Rebecca reached out to me out of the blue to take this on. And then this whole new energy would use this vessel to a greater mission. It was like a rebirth, reborn in the same physical shell. But it's because the energy needed the shell, because the shell was highly equipped with communication skills, with leadership skills. I mean, if you were the universe and you wanted to spread a positive message, or you needed to offset all the negativity that's happening in the world, like, who would you choose? You know, what vessels would you choose? You choose all the vessels. I'm not the only chosen one. There's so many other vessels being chosen around the world, you know. Who would you choose? You would choose the equipped ones. You choose the people who don't procrastinate. You choose the driven people. You choose the people who can communicate, who can lead, who can motivate. So So it was a rebirth in this physical. And it was a big mission because when I came back, still having the memories, memory cannot go because brain is there. Emotion and stored memory is still there from Eriko and the whole upbringing. That's why we can tell all these stories. But that sometimes that observer would be able to observe when I came back from the mountains, I realized that this person was highly, highly driven, working every single day, where Eriko was not like that. He was already very content. He would do his speaking gigs, but he would also party and have fun and enjoy. When this energy came through, I became an observer and everybody else around me was observing. It became very strict and very straight to the point and no BS in between and get stuff done all day long, no rest, keep going. And it wouldn't stand for lazy people. Eriko would stand for lazy people. Like some people who are a little bit lazy, it's okay, give and take. Some people work harder, some people don't, it's okay. This energy didn't allow it. That's why the moment this energy came through and I went back to UK, it got rid of a few people from the team because it knew it had a huge mission and it didn't have time for people who were lazying around.
Wow.
So I was an observer. It was a very interesting journey, yeah.
And you really dove into it full. You changed your name legally, all your documents.
Passport, driving license, everything.
Everything.
Yeah,
so
literally on September the 15th, September the 15th was when it happened, yeah.
So you truly transformed. No more Eriko.
Yeah, and everything holds energy also. Everything holds energy. Name holds energy as well. This is a very powerful, actually, Akashana means attraction. Attraction. The Shri part is wealth and abundance. But this is not to attract for self. I still live in the same house that I've lived in for the last 10 years. I've even sold the Lamborghini. So it's not to attract for self. Mm. Because we come into this world with nothing, we leave with nothing. Yeah. What we can do for this world is to empower people and give that wealth and knowledge and abundance and give it out, contribute.
Yeah. Did you ever have a breakthrough of your own after working with a mentee or disciple even that brought you to higher levels?
I think at all times we're learning. Yeah. I think all times we're learning. So we all learn from each other. I think that breakthroughs are happening all the time.
I see. So what's next for Master Sri Akarshana?
Well, we have to first deal with the thing at hand, which is the chaos happening in the world. And I remember when I first came from the mountains, we already had this conversation and you had launched the video on the predictions already. By the way, I mean, predictions is something that people will resonate with that we put out on social media, but these are not predictions, you know? It's like this recession that's coming. It's not a prediction. I'm not predicting this. It's going to happen, you know? Mm. It's a knowing. So with everything that's happening, we first need to empower people with wealth tools, with strong capacity, body, mind, spirit connection. They need to be strong to be able to go through this tough time. When I first came from the mountains, that was 2019, I believe, right? 2019, September, then the name changed. Then November already, we were in San Diego, we were in Long Beach, and then we held the events, the private sessions, and I was already warning everybody of the chaos that was about to happen. Then officially, January, February, March, everything started to kick off 2020. So now is not the end. 2021 is for new beginnings. 2020 was the reset. 2022 is alignment year, still a very fast year. 2023 will calm down slightly. Mm. Calm down slightly is first calm. So first time we can breathe a little bit, relax a little bit. But we should be working extremely hard right now, building up wealth, building up consciousness, building up ourself, self-realization, starting new projects. Everybody should be doing that. Our goal right now is to empower people with the skill sets and the tools to do so. Empower people with that strength. And our second goal is to unite people, bring people together in love and positivity, in wealth and consciousness. Because coming towards the end of this year and beginning and also next year, with all the chaos that's happening around the world, there's going to be a lot of people needing help. And the helpless will not be able to go out there and help. You have to have the capacity to help, to be able to help. And so that's why we're building people up right now. Because in the coming years, there's going to be a few other things that's going to be happening in the world that we will need to step up and come together and heal the world.
So this year is about building skills, building wealth, or at least accumulating cash?
Yeah. So there's a few, yeah. Number one, accumulate cash. Recession's going to hit. So now you can put a prediction out for people. Recession's going to hit. You can mark my word on that. It's going to hit and it's coming soon. So it's like a time ticking. You want to build as much capital as you can before recession hits. When recession hits, things will go below maybe 30% below market value or even greater, depending on which part of the recession. When it gets 30% below market value already, we should be investing. So right now, you need to build. Everybody needs to be building their investing knowledge. So when it comes to the time that things come below market value, around 30%, that's your good indication to go in. Real estate is a good thing. So when you buy, don't use cash. Don't use your capital. So leverage. So I always recommend all our students, all our disciples, I'm recommending two things right now. Number one, try to accumulate as much money as possible. And number two, build up a good credit. If you have a good credit, build up an even better relationship with the banks and lenders right now. So when the 30% hit comes in, you will leverage banks' money, borrow money, put in as little capital as you can, and accumulate, buy as much as you can. You'll be doing that over the next few years. And then after 3 years' time, it's home run. Because after when the retraction happens, when the retraces, what you can build up in terms of wealth and wealth consciousness in the next 3 years, even if you work extremely hard for 10, 12 years, you can't accumulate what will happen in the next 3 years. So this is our one shot in this physical lifetime anyway. And so...
Once in a lifetime opportunity here,
yeah,
coming up.
Yeah. And I always say to people, I say there's only two outcomes from this. There's going to be two bunches of people. There's going to be the first bunch of people who... They say, thank you so much, Master Sri Akashana. I listened to your interview back then with Jay Menez and I took your advice, and now I've not only become a multimillionaire in a few years, but I'm also doing a lot of charity work and helping a lot of people out there. So that'd be scenario number one. Scenario number two is the palm to forehead people. You know those people? I remember watching that interview one day. Why did I not take action? So, you know, but I always say to people say, oh, I don't believe what he's saying. I said, it doesn't matter whether you believe me or not. I don't need anybody to believe me. You know, I don't win anything from anybody believing me. But I always say, you've got no loss in doing the work. You can never lose. Mm. You'll never lose anything in putting in the efforts. Yeah.
You speak a lot on the law of attraction, and it's a topic that attracts a lot of attention. And a lot of people may not completely understand it, especially those with the more logical or scientific mind. How would you best describe how it works in the least woo-woo way possible?
I think like that. You see? I smiled, you smile. You see, like that. this law of attraction, no? They put out positivity, positivity comes back. You see? I don't know how many punches you can take before you start punching me back, but I'm sure if I start doing that, then something eventually will come back, right? So it's like that. If I start beating you up, I'm sure something will come back, you know? Even if it's little, something will come back, you know? Yeah. I don't know what. So this is universe response. It's normal. You go out, smile to the next 50 people you see what comes back. Yeah, you go out, frown at the next 50 people you see what you get back, you know? People say law of attraction isn't real. I say it's law of attraction. It's not your opinion. It's not your opinion of attraction here, you know? Walk out today and say, law of gravity is not working today. You cannot say it's law of gravity. It's the way energies work. I'll tell you the easiest way to identify it is like a radio station. Radio station, you see, it has a frequency. If you tune into that frequency, all you hear is whatever that channel's about. Imagine if you had positivity FM and then you have negativity FM. One's all screaming, shouting, and swearing. The other one's all love and positivity, right? Imagine one's 97.7, one's 105.7, right? So it's just like that. When you tune into a frequency, all your surrounding changes to that thing. When you tune into another frequency, all your surrounding tunes into that thing. So you see it. You start seeing it. People say manifestation. How does it work? Prove to me it works. I say, you tell me, how did you manifest your breakfast this morning? If you tell me that, then we're done. Because I ask people, I say, how you manifested your breakfast this morning? I said, did you think about having breakfast? I say, yes. I said, okay, thought. That's step one in law of attraction. I said, did you believe that you were going to be able to get your breakfast? Or did you doubt and fear? Maybe it's not going to show up today. Right? Or did you believe? They said, yes, I believe. I said, okay, belief. Second point of law of attraction, right? I said, number three, I said, was there a big desire? Was there a desire wanting it? Or were you like, I don't really want breakfast. Did you get breakfast not really wanting breakfast? Or did you get breakfast wanting breakfast? Oh, desire was there. Okay, cool. Burning desire. Napoleon Hill speaks about that too. I said, okay, third point, burning desire was there. Okay. Number four, I said, did you take any action to get your breakfast? Like, did you stand up? Did you pour the cereal? Did you order the breakfast? I said, yes. You took action. Great. Law of attraction. Right? So I said, you took action. Great. You did that. I said, okay, finally, you took the action. I said, the final thing, after you've taken the action, were you doubting and fearing? And were you highly attached to the outcome? Like, were you like, while you're pouring the cereal and things, you were thinking, like, oh, I hope this turns out okay. And I hope it doesn't fall on the floor. Or were you like, I trust that everything's going to be okay and I'm going to consume this breakfast, right? So probably you trusted. I said, okay, cool. Next point is tick. The final point. When the parcel finally arrived, the thing that you manifested finally arrived, were you open to receiving this thing? Right? Were you like, okay, breakfast is here, let's consume it now? Or were you feeling like closed? Were you not open to receiving it? Were you feeling like, I'm not sure I deserve this thing. I'm not sure I'm good enough for this breakfast today. Or did you openly receive it? If you openly received it, the final thing, you received your parcel. That is manifestation. So, law of attraction, manifestation, every single thing in life we manifest. We manifest our way here on this show. Everybody who's watching this show, they manifested their way to clicking the button and watching this thing because they desired watching the thing.
Right. All right. And so the law of attraction, being a law, and I'm just mirroring back what you're saying here, it is working all the time, whether we believe in it or not. It's always working. And there are manifestation practices that you teach that are out there. If it's working all the time, why are these practices necessary?
That's a very good question. It's because we have something called a conscious, which is I know the way, I know what I'm thinking to speak right now. That's conscious, right? Or I'm consciously going to raise my hand, right? Or the subconscious, I didn't know subconsciously my four fingers were still pointed at you. Do you get what I'm saying? I didn't know. You subconsciously, your foot is slanted, right? Subconsciously, we're slouching. There's the subconscious that is in play, right? Then there's the superconscious, meaning that on an energetic level, the universe level, there is also attraction. There is positive, there is negative that's happening. And so if there's these three levels, why there's practices, most of the practices is trying to align the three. Because when we consciously want something, let's say, for example, I consciously want to succeed. I consciously want to make money, okay? Whenever, let's say, whenever there's a money opportunity, I fear or I doubt. I'm like, I'm not sure this opportunity is for me. I'm good enough for it. That's subconscious. You consciously want to make money, but your subconscious is not helping you. So it's not aligned. What is the, if law of attraction is working all of the time, why is it sometimes we don't get what we want? It's because we don't get what we want. Law of attraction works by we get what we are. So what we want is conscious. What we are is the alignment of the conscious, the superconscious, and the subconscious, these three things.
I see. So that's a part of aligning.
That's right. So when we do any rituals, any affirmations, any meditations, any vision boards or anything, it's all about aligning all of our energies towards that goal.
Wonderful. If there were a moral to your story, what would it be and why?
I think as common as this is, but I think it's to be fearless and to never give up. Because I think that as kids, we are fearless. We dare ask questions. We dare dream. We dare do anything. We dare laugh and cry and express whenever we want to. We dare fall over in the act and journey of learning to walk. But I think that as adults, they don't have that daringness anymore. They don't have that courage anymore. They have more fear, more doubts. They have more thoughts, more negative beliefs. And they're overthinking a lot of situations. They are fearful of taking the step because if I take the step, what if I fall over? Where they don't remember that when they were a kid, what if you fall over? Stand back up, right? That's what happened. That's how you learn. That's how you move forward. And I think that the biggest thing when I look at all the different parts of my life and everything that I've achieved or even been challenged in, I believe that I've been fearless. I accept that challenges is a part of life. I accept that there are no storms that last forever, that pain is always temporary. I accept that as long as you stay solution-focused, you can get out of any challenge. And I accept that if the world didn't have challenges, it would be an extremely boring game to play. If your goal in life was just to sit there and smile and there was no challenges, I think we would be like, again, questioning, what is my purpose in life, you know? So because there's challenges, challenges are a blessing in disguise to make you stronger. So I think that be fearless. If you feel something, do it. You feel that that's your calling, that's your emotion, that's the energy in motion, that's the universe speaking through you, or that God calling, that gut feeling, or that God feeling. So feel it. Follow your heart, take action, be fearless.
And if you could describe your most important core value in a single word, what would it be?
I think integrity. And I think integrity, not as a positive word or a negative word. For some reason, people think integrity is a positive word. Integrity, if you are integral with something, is saying your actions and everything is aligned and integral with your beliefs. So even people who are doing bad things out there, they're integral. But I think it's a very important thing in life because I think integrity is almost like alignment, absolute alignment. And I think that is an extremely important thing to develop if you're wanting to succeed in any area of life. So I would say integrity is a big thing. Integral with the way you think, the way you speak, the way you act, the way you are, yeah.
How would you advise somebody on finding that integrity?
I think it's witness. Become the witnesser. Become the observer. So we do it anyway at times when sometimes we can say stupid things and we observe ourselves. You hear yourself. You're like, did I just say that? Or sometimes we even, maybe we're doing some gesture. We don't even know. Maybe we're sat there like this and we don't even know or something. And we realize that cameras are on us or people are looking at us, right? And after a while, we're like, I think I look really stupid right now, right? So you're observing. So I think when we are fully present in every moment, practice presence of mind, nowism. When we practice that and we're totally present in that moment, we can observe our thoughts. What are we thinking? Observe our feelings. What are we feeling? Are we feeling good? If not, tweak. Right? Observe our words that come from our mouth. Right? Is it the case that in the morning we're like, I am abundance, I am rich, I am a millionaire? Then what happens is you go to the supermarket and you say, I get the cheapest one, please. Right? So observe. Hey, did that just come from me? Because that's not integral to what I'm chanting in the morning. You see? Observe your actions. So observe the way you are. I think being present in the moment, observing, being the observer, the witnesser, then correcting. Whatever points is not integral, not aligned, correct. I think that is your fastest way to develop.
Brilliant. Well, we should all be so self-aware. So tell us all where we can find you and learn more about what you do.
I think pretty much all social media platforms, they can find me on YouTube. YouTube is the biggest following so far. So YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, some stuff I do on Facebook, not so much anymore. Clubhouse now is also. Yeah, so they can find me on all social platforms.
They're all Master Sri Akarshana?
All Master Sri Akarshana. Or they can also go to iamcreator.com, which is our circle, our community. So they can find any different events that we have is all there.
Brother, I always enjoy spending this time with you. It's always so amazing. I learn a lot. I get inspired. And just a joy to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the conversation.
Thank you.
All right.